A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hello, I'm Helen, and I'm not Stephen, but Stephen's gone home. Welcome to the New Statesman podcast. This week, Stephen and I catch up on all the latest from the campaigns. We talk to Spencer Livermore, Lord Livermore, who ran Labour's previous general election campaigns, about what's different this time. Kate Mossman joins us to talk about 20 years since Cool Britannia. And finally, I do a dramatic reading of the New Statesman's 2nd of May 1997, optimistic, hopeful new Labour leader. Let's talk about the election, Stephen.
Woohoo!
Okay, so I started off my campaign by being asked for a prediction on the week in Westminster, and I already regret it deeply because I said two things, which is one, that I wanted to go out and talk to people, which I'm going to at the end of this week, and secondly, that I had only succeeded in making any predictions in the last 18 months when I assumed the worst possible result for the left, Liberals. And therefore, I said a Tory majority of 50 seats. Now, having talked to more people, I am in the fabled hair on fire territory of thinking that, certainly in terms of overall vote share, I think I feel very pessimistic about Labour. Whether or not they can run local campaigns is now, I guess, the question. But you know, a poll had them on no seats in Scotland, 12 seats for the Tories there. Another poll that came out on Monday with Roger Scully had the Conservatives 10 points ahead in Wales, which was the only one of the four nations of the UK that Labour won last time. I am feeling less good for Labour.
Yeah, I mean, so the difficulty is if you go into an election with your leader's results, you know, his polling being where it is, there are two things which can happen. One, you can use the TV debates to turn people around on your guy, or what will tend to happen is a process where your leadership rating and your party rating meet somewhere in the middle. Obviously, somewhere in the middle is 18-19%. 19% feels to me a plausible idea of where Labour's floor might be, because that's what they got in the European elections. Although, actually, I think they've had... So it's an interesting thing. The polls are obviously awful. It doesn't look to me like Labour is turning around. However, they are actually having quite a good campaign. To bore on and on, as I do every week, about what goes on the radio, when I do Morning Call, my email, which if you haven't signed up to yet, you really should. When I do Morning Call, I either listen to Radio 6 or 6 Music, where you just get the news every half an hour. And actually, they are doing a very good job of Jeremy Corbyn's going to give you something nice, often something very reasonable and from kind of, you know, very mainstream left stuff, you know, more bank holidays, free school meals for all primary pupils. The Conservatives have kind of said, oh, only a strong economy can deliver Labour's nice policy. And the Lib Dems have gone, only the Lib Dems can be somewhere equidistant between these two parties, which actually is not a bad place for their message to be. They've been boosted by the fact that this has had remarkably few retirements. I can find no example of the polls being this bad for a party where, yeah, so 2010, you know, Labour predicted to lose lots of seats, which they did. They, you know, they Tories made 97 gains, their record since 1931 for a single night. loads of MPs retired. 1997, ditto, loads of Conservative MPs retired because they were, they looked at the polls and went, do you know what, mate, you're all right, thanks. Although, amusingly, lots of Tory MPs also stood down in 1992 thinking they'd lose and then didn't.
Lol.
But it helps that Labour's personal majority, where MPs have worked hard and been there for a long time, won't be standing down.
Now, and hang on a minute, because you are Mr. There is no such thing as a personal vote.
I'm not, there's no such thing as a personal vote.
There's no difference from an incumbency factor, I guess?
Yeah, I think the thing is, there is such a thing as a personal vote. However, like, if you've got an amazing personal vote, so some people who are smarter and have better computers than I did some regression on, say, Douglas Carswell, right? And you can sort of find about maybe 2,000 people who voted for him. But that includes, A, the fact he took a lot of his local association with him. He certainly took most of the activists. He didn't take that many members, but in terms of the people who went out on doors, knew how to work the photocopiers, right? So your personal vote is a lot of things, right? It's like your brother-in-law who does all of the number crunching, so you know where the vote is. It's the people you've helped. It's the people who've seen you because you opened their school, etc., etc. But the thing about that personal vote is, if your personal vote is 2,000, 3,000, that is brilliant. Unless, of course, there's a national swing that is bigger than 2,000 or 3,000 votes. And there is no seat where 2,000, 3,000 votes can get you elected without a party, or is indeed meaningful in its own right. The Douglas Carswell claim is, he once claimed he had a personal vote of 9,000, which you just can't make work in terms of what happened to the Tories and UKIP elsewhere. But there is an incumbency factor, which is most powerful among second-term MPs. So one of the, to talk about the big thing this week, which I think is the Lib Dems, one of the problems for the Lib Dems in terms of, oh, they're going to gain all these seats back, is what tends to happen is, if you've been in office for one term and you're an MP, I don't know who else you'd have been in office, and you're running again, what tends to happen is people go, hasn't killed us yet, and you get a slight boost, which is one of the reasons why the electoral map has got worse and worse for Labour every time. So you had like those 10 gains or whatever it was in 2005, and they all got this massive swing in 2010. Then in 2015, obviously they gained seats in both 2010, but then the 2010 gains had this massive swing towards them in excess of the national swing to the Tories. And that made the map more formidable for Labour still. Ignoring what we think and all of the polls and so far all of the local council elections point to, which is a further loss of seats, the other thing to watch out for will be massive increases in the Tory lead in, say, Gower, 27 votes.
So they won Gower by 27 votes last time, so you would expect them to solidify that majority. There are two things that I think are really, that we didn't, I was talking earlier about how we got last time wrong, and it was because we thought that, yes, there'd be lots of defections away from the Lib Dems to punish them for going into coalition. What we didn't really see was that those would go to the Tories, who they were in coalition with, rather than Labour, the opposition. So the two big factors, I guess, this time are, do the Lib Dems actually pick up a lot of seats, or is their vote too diffuse to really help them make gains? And also, is UKIP an extant political force anymore? And or is that just vote being just eaten up and boosting the Tories, particularly in places like Wales?
Yeah, and in Wales, it's particularly bad for Labour because, so the UKIP vote is predominantly, but not exclusively, former Conservative. But also the other thing about former Conservative, right, is it depends where you start the point, right? If someone voted Labour 97, Labour 2001, Labour 2005, or Tory 2005, and then Tory 2010, are they a Labour or a Conservative voter? Are they a swing voter? Yeah, et cetera, et cetera. But
this sounds like a theological argument, Stephen, which brings me neatly onto Tim Farron.
Tim Farron, yeah.
So you interviewed him for the magazine, and let's not beat around the bush, he turned off all the lights in his house and pretended to be out when you tried to follow him up with some questions about gay sex.
Yeah, so I interviewed him before the snap election was announced. There's a bit which I didn't include because it felt excessively cruel, seeing as I loudly agreed with him on the tape. So obviously you can put something in where the other person gets something wrong and be like, well, I, a far-sighted... He kind of went at one point, if there was an election tomorrow, which there won't be. So most of it was in Manchester Gorton. Then the sort of questions about whether or not he thinks that gay sex is sinful re-erupted. And yes, for a variety of reasons, he did not get back to me. They did finally, after a couple of days, sort of realise that they were going to have to sit on the grenade, and he kind of went, I don't think that gay sex is a sin.
But I think the point to take about this, well, there are a couple of points, which is one, which is a kind of, like I said on the podcast last week, I did feel there was an almost a sense of glee about it from some Labour activists who have had a right old shellacking for still saying with Labour when, you know, Jeremy Corbyn goes on press TV, right, or, you know, whatever it is, being able to say, well, you know, you act like Tim Farron's shit don't stink. Actually, here's the thing that he's got wrong. So I did see a bit of that on it. But also the fact that he handled it so badly says bad things about the Lib Dem kind of seaworthiness, right?
Yeah, I think in... So I think there are a couple of things I think which are true about the row. One, my instinct, and one of the good things about elections is they stress test your sort of basic hunches. But my instinct is that the Lib Dems can get away with a lot of shit because for a lot of people, the point is who they're not. In this case, they're not a Tory party committed to Brexit. They're not a Riven Labour Party driven... A Riven party led by a man they don't much like. So in an odd way, as long as the Lib Dems are not those two things, which they're not, because the whole point of Lib Dems is, odds and sods, they will
there
be fine.
There goes our Lib Dem listener.
We actually have a large Lib Dem listenership, and I love all of them. So my instinct is that it means they'll be fine in terms of having a success this election. However, in terms of their dream, which is that they can use this election to not just restore their status as the third party, but become Britain's main opposition and eventually the government, I think that shows them that's been held below the waterline. The other thing is, I suspect they will have a very good local election. And at that point, the full force of the Tory attack machine, their allies in the right-wing press, will obviously largely be concentrated on Labour, but a large chunk of it will turn to the Liberal Democrats. And I think we learned how effectively the Lib Dems have war-gamed their ability to get through that kind of situation. And it turns out the answer is not well at all. So with the Tim Farron stuff, it was an issue in the leadership election that he believed that he was, you know, an evangelical Christian who has, in terms of the stuff he's voted for, his voting record is good. However, he has, and this is something that actually a non-trivial number of sort of Labour MPs have done, he has gone missing on votes.
There's some
on
suspicious
abortion and homosexuality.
Yeah.
So it should have been obvious that they needed to have, and he also got a battering from Cathy Newman immediately after being elected. It should have been obvious, and I think it was obvious to a lot of people in the Lib Dems, that they needed to have a answer on it that was, as you say, seaworthy. They didn't have one. And then they eventually got dragged into...
Yeah, so at my point, it looked like he said something that he didn't really believe after having been beaten up by his advisors for 7 days into saying it, which is a kind of... I mean, at least it closes the issue down. I think it was probably... I mean, definitely morally it's the right thing to do, but, you know, tactically I think it was really the right thing to do. But it has taken a little bit of the shine off Tim Farron. Anyway, we've got lots of other sections to get through, Stephen, so we can't have any time to talk about all the amazing policies that Theresa May has announced.
Which is just as well, because there aren't any.
Thank you very much. Here all week.
And now we're joined by Spencer Livermore, Labour peer, veteran of not only the 1997 general election campaign, but 2001, 2005 and 2015. To draw on his memories of all of those contests. I really want to not
wallow in 1990s nostalgia because it makes me happy. It's my happy place. So at what point during the 97 campaign did it become obvious that the scale of the victory become obvious?
I think for me, and I remember it incredibly vividly, was the last 2 days of the campaign we were all sort of sent out on buses throughout the country to key seats. I remember getting on the coach to come back on the last day, and the exit poll came on the radio, and it was a huge scale. And I think no one on the campaign had allowed themselves to believe that it would be even a victory, never mind a huge victory, because pretty much everyone on that campaign was scarred by 92. I mean, even me, who was at school in 92, remember sitting up watching the results in 92 and being utterly devastated. And obviously many of the people who were very senior on that campaign in 97 had been very active and very senior on the campaign in 92. And so they all carried those very personal memories. And so the whole campaign was dominated by a determination, not just not to be complacent, but just almost not to allow yourself to believe in case it happened again. And so for me personally, I think for many people, it was only when it really became almost real at 10 o'clock on that night that we really allowed ourselves to believe what was happening.
My other question is then, because I've been doing editing lots of our stuff that's from our archive that's immediately post 1997 election, and this feeling of optimism. I think even if the Tories win a big, big, big majority this time, I don't think they're going to have, there's not going to be that euphoria. I mean, there'll be a sense of triumphalism, right? But I don't think that spirit's coming back this time, is it? It doesn't feel like a euphoric election.
It doesn't, but then I suppose we're on the wrong side to know whether there's any euphoria. I mean, obviously in 97, if you were a Tory, you probably weren't feeling massively euphoric. And so I guess it's hard to compare directly, but I think you're right. There's not the sense of, this is not an optimistic campaign unless you are the hardest of hard Brexiteer and you've achieved everything you've been fighting for. But I think even in the country, 97 was about, as you say, optimism, a sense of renewal, a sense of modernization, a sense of progress. None of those things particularly feel present now. And obviously for all of us on the sort of left, centre left, this feels like the end of progress or the arresting of progress. And particularly, I think, we feel that, I think if you're on the centre left, you're supposed to believe in this narrative of continuous progress. And suddenly we see all of the things, all the progressive things that we believe in about to end. And that is, the polar opposite, I suppose, of 97.
So in 97, there were there was a fifth channel launched that year, but there were four major channels, a much more limited and therefore easily controlled media landscape. By the time you were sort of running the show in 2015, there was this hugely fragmented social media, et cetera, et cetera. How much do you think the lessons of media management from 1997 can still apply in 2017?
I think you're right. I really do vividly remember 97 and 2001, to be honest, the same. Literally gathering around the television sort of three or four times a day for the news broadcast. And pretty much everything you did was geared around the 1 p.m. news, the 6 o'clock news, 10 o'clock news, and then tomorrow's papers. And they were incredibly fixed moments of the day. By 2015, as you say, the news cycle was minuscule. A story would last maybe an hour, maybe 2 hours. And it transforms the nature of the campaign because you don't have one big story each day. You have to have multiple stories each day, which you can control far less. And the other thing I think that has totally changed, not just what you describe in terms of the news cycle, but also the leaders' debates. Now, it looks like they're not going to happen this time to anything like the same degree. But 97, 2001, 2005, you had a morning press conference. Each party had a morning press conference. And that was your ability, really, to control the story of the day, your ability to respond to your opponent's story of the day, and try and set the agenda each day. That gave, I think, the campaigns much more control over the campaign. Now it feels much more like the media has control over the campaign, and the campaigns are responding to the agenda the media is more able to set. So I think it has really shifted the balance of power between the two respective groupings within the campaigns.
What are the ingredients of a successful political general election campaign?
I think increasingly I'm of the view that campaigns don't massively matter.
This is not what I want to hear 6 weeks out of spending every weekend writing about campaigns, but go on.
I think that there are some exceptions to that. I think perhaps 2005 could be an exception to that, and 92 is probably an exception to that. But I think broadly, the outcome of an election is set a year or more prior to the actual event. And really, the election is sort of, sometimes it's an exercise in just making sure you don't slip up properly, which was like what 1997 was like. Or sometimes it's, you know, a desperate attempt to claw something back, perhaps like it was for Labour in 2015. But if the fundamentals are in the wrong place, however good your campaign is, you're not going to be able to fix the fundamentals in those 6 weeks. I think, you know, elections are won on competence, on the economy, on leadership. And if those things are not present, a campaign is not going to change.
I think that's true. I always hope that we're at least, the campaigns that I've covered, we're learning from our mistakes. And I think probably, you know, the I agree with Nick debate moment, we probably over-covered that, right?
I don't know. So my instinct is actually, I think, in terms of the Tories not squeezing the Lib Dems further, I feel I agree with Nick probably did matter a bit. In my instinct is it would have been, obviously they lost seats anyway, but I mean, I know that you weren't in that election, but obviously you're a keen observer of all these things. Do you think the debates mattered at all in 2010?
I think maybe when on my list of campaigns that mattered, perhaps 2010 did matter, in as much as the Tories had a very, very poor campaign and they missed the opportunity probably to get the majority they should have got and ended up in a hung parliament. Did debates matter? I think they did, in as much as the one thing debates can do is level the playing field, particularly when you're at a financial disadvantage, because they give you guaranteed moments throughout the campaign where you are guaranteed exposure, on a level playing field that you just couldn't get without debates being there. So I think that Labour had far less money to spend than the Conservatives. A lot of the time, Labour was on the back foot, and on a good day, Gordon compared very well, favourably to David Cameron in that kind of setting. So I think that they did play a part and they did contribute to Labour having a much more creditable campaign than perhaps otherwise we would have done. So I think I probably would add 2010 to the list of campaigns that mattered.
And if you were, this is a very unfair question, if you were running the Labour campaign this time, assuming you can't change anything, you can't get in a time machine and undo, you know, any news stories that have happened, anything like that, what things should it be doing? What things should we look out for to see whether or not it is doing to kind of gauge its success as a campaign, regardless of the result?
I think, really, the less they do, the better.
That's bad news for journalists, because Theresa May doesn't want to do anything either, so it's just going to like bore us all.
I think I'm of the view that Jeremy Corbyn's current unpopularity or unpopularity so far has been driven by his absence rather than his presence, in as much as people dislike the fact that he is not a strong leader, the fact that he is not particularly dynamic, not particularly effective, and broadly, the Labour Party has been quite incompetent being led by him. That is what I think is driving the current low level of Labour in the polls.
What if he punched someone like John Prescott did? Because actually, weirdly, didn't that kind of go quite well for John Prescott, in that it turned John Prescott into this, John Prescott, he's such a rogue?
I, having sat there in 2001, I don't remember it being
a good day. It was probably not a good day from the inside. Okay, fair
actually,
enough.
If you remember that day, it was the day when Tony Blair was confronted by Sharon Storer. Jack Straw was booed by the Police Federation. And I think all three of those things happened on the same day.
Was that the worst day of the campaign?
It was definitely the worst day of the campaign. But, you know, the reason that didn't derail that campaign is because the fundamentals were in the right place. And the strategy was so strong that it pulled us back onto the tracks that we should have been on, and you weren't derailed. A campaign that had much weaker fundamentals and weaker foundations would have been derailed by events of that magnitude. And I think that sort of proves the point that it's about these fundamentals, it's about these train tracks.
What's the single biggest event that has completely upturned your strategy for campaign, or been the hardest thing to react to in any ones you've worked on?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't remember one specific event, but it's, you know, every day is a battle between the story you want and the story your opponents want to dominate the day. And, you know, in countless times, that if the Tories have a stronger story than you, then how the best laid plans are completely blown away, and you spend the whole day on the defensive, the whole day trying to, you know, explain away their allegations about you. And that, you know, You want more days in a campaign to be your days than your opponent's days if you're going to win. And if every day is spent responding to their stories rather than setting the agenda yourself, that is what a losing campaign looks like.
I guess we've got into the habit because of the referendum in thinking that civil wars are the most interesting things to the most interesting contests that there are. And I think the Tories have, it's very notable, like the resignations from the Open Britain, you know, they have instantly snapped back into ultra loyalists, whatever that Linton Crosby thing is about not being commentators, you're competitors or
your participants.
Participants. Not, yeah. So you are not there to give your running commentary, you're just there to be a foot soldier, right? That is a difficult media environment because then what the media presumably wants to write about, it's got very trained to write about Boris versus Dave and internal Labour splits. So trying to say, actually, no, the contest you want to pay attention to is Labour versus the Tories, that feels sort of, people don't want to be like, oh yeah, obviously you hate the Tories, yeah, whatever. It must be quite hard to get those messages across.
I think that both Labour and the Conservatives are in deeply, deeply tribal organisations full of people who have huge loyalty towards their party. And in an election time, everyone remembers who the main enemy is and is focused on fighting that enemy because everyone in the Labour Party believes that any Labour government is always going to be better than any Conservative government. And that's what you're fighting for. I do think that there is obviously a lot of kind of commentary about inter-party splits, but that is inevitably going to be the case when Labour is less competitive than it ordinarily should be. It's very hard for, I presume, journalists to write with a straight face that Labour is competitive for power when our poll ratings are half the Conservative Party's poll ratings.
It's quite hard for Theresa May to keep a straight face, to be honest with you, which is one of the things I'm enjoying. You know, Theresa May trying to kind of put her kind of like, no, I'm very concerned. I mean, you know, I know it's 24 points in the polls, but the polls have been wrong before.
But yeah, in terms of this point about his absence, so would you say, so why do you think his increased presence would be a problem now?
I think when you have a leader with kind of subterranean approval ratings, I think he's reached the lowest level ever today with YouGov at minus 65 or something. The more exposure that person gets, the worse it gets for the party. Therefore, you know, a sensible strategy in that situation is to try and have as least exposure as you possibly can.
In terms of, you know, again, you know, you can't change the policies, you've just inherited the situation. How would you say Theresa May is doing? Obviously, in terms of the politics, she looks on course for a big win. But would you say it's a great campaign, or, you know, how would you manage that one?
I think that for me, everything you see about the campaign so far from both parties is two parties who weren't ready and expecting an election. So it's very much a phony war at the moment. You know, I'm sure Theresa May had to keep the decision and incredibly secret, and all credit to them, they did keep it incredibly secret, but that means very few people knew. And it's really apparent that they didn't have a lot of the rudiments of a campaign in place, and obviously neither did Labour. So they're doing sort of some set piece visits that presumably are very easy to arrange at short notice, but that's it at the moment. And I presume that once Parliament ends and we move into a more formal campaign, they will have had time to catch up with that and you know, construct a proper grid and run a more lively campaign. I think the politics, as you say, the Conservative Party have done well in framing the campaign on her terms. They have framed the campaign around leadership and which, you know, who do you want to send into the negotiations to represent Britain? And that obviously is a question that favours the Conservatives, and that's why they framed it in that way. It depends how that plays out. It feels a very boring campaign at the moment, definitely.
Tell me about it.
Incredibly boring. But then when you look at in the evening news broadcast, you can see some very, very professional pictures coming back from the Conservative Party, perhaps less so from Labour, but you can see why they're playing it so safe, because if you think elections are won on in that metric in terms of what the pictures look like each day, then they're doing very well so far.
Can I ask you one final question, which is, what's the happiest, nicest, we need a bit of joy and uplift, what's the nicest, happiest memory you have of any of the campaigns you've worked on?
In fairness, all the four of the campaigns I've worked on have been amazing experiences. Campaigns are brilliant things to work on. They are incredibly bonding experiences. You make friendships for life. Everyone, you know, throughout sort of the Blair Brown years, obviously there were degrees of division, but everyone during those campaigns comes together They were one team seeking one objective, to beat the Tories. And obviously winning is the greatest moment imaginable. And, you know, those three election victories when we won, nothing compares to that. And I have incredibly fond memories, and they are huge fun to work on. But even in 2015, it's still a very fun thing to do. It's a very nice, pleasant experience to work on a campaign, and I would recommend it to anyone.
Okay. I think there's probably a few people in Labour this time who think, that would be not maybe the first campaign to cut your teeth on this year. But I like that. I like your optimism. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
And now Kate Mossman, our arts editor and pop critic, is joining us to talk about the music of 1997. Well, as you've written, Tracy Thorne's got a great piece in the magazine this week about what it was like to be at those sort of strange Brit Awards where Tony Blair turned up and met David Bowie. But people were listening to Rubbish. Sorry, Stephen, to break this to you, but we were listening to... What we actually dominated the charts was Rubbish.
That makes me feel a bit better, because, to be honest, what I know about Britpop wouldn't fill a cup until we were talking about this in what I'm now going to refer to as the green room, i.e. this room when the sound is turned off. I thought that Song 2 was Britpop, but apparently it's not. I mean, it's by Blur. You know, like...
Why is that not Britpop? I think a load of stuff seems surpassed for Britpop now in retrospect. Like
but doesn't
Black Grape.
Oh. Fat Neck? Yeah. Oh, that was a terrible song. I just think Blur, the Britpop era, I think ends with Park Life, actually. Weirdly, 1997 is kind of the end of Britpop. In a way... Becoming the kind of dominant political force kind of took some of the cultural wind out of sails. And, Be Here Now, which is the kind of most overhyped albums. I think it was Dorian Lynskey was saying, if you read the initial reviews for it, clearly when everyone was whacked off their tits, they're all like, this is amazing. And you listen to it now and it's just 11 of the same song.
So, Kate, imagine you're talking to a musical idiot. Perhaps that won't be hard for you to imagine in this context. Explain what is Britpop? Like, explain its kind of moods and...
Sort of very commercially successful and carefully orchestrated battle between essentially three or four bands, which we all remember. And this is the way history views that era, is that, you know, it was just Blur, it was just Oasis, it was just Pulp. And the great thing, we did a little bit of a kind of revisionist look at the era, and we looked at the big sellers. The biggest selling single of 97 was Candle in the Wind, followed closely by Missing You by Puff Daddy and Faith Evans. There was also, everyone was listening to Barbie Girl.
That, I remember, that is a great song.
This was like 4 weeks at number one in the kind of honeymoon period straight after the election.
Come on,
in a way,
Barbie,
that is the
party.
That's the soundtrack.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
In the same way that D. Ream's Things Can Only Get Better and Katrina and the Waves' Love Shine a Light, which was this wonderful kind of vote of confidence for the rest of the world at the time of the Eurovision.
Do you know what I really want to listen to? If anyone out there has got a keyboard and more musical ability than me, I want someone to rescore Things Can Only Get Better to be in a minor key, because I really feel like that should be the soundtrack. To 2017 should just be a sort of really sad, plungent version of Things Can Only Get Better. You know, like what I mean?
It was
Lana Del Rey kind of version. Of it.
Yeah. I mean, we think of it as being this sort of the great cultural party that was being had by the nation. But if you think of that, the mawkishness of Missing You and Candle in the Wind as being the two big hits of that year, Tracy makes this lovely point in her piece where she remembers being at the 96 Brits, and sitting on the table alongside members of Massive Attack.
Goldie was on her table?
Goldie, possibly, maybe even Bjork. And just looking at this kind of very white, very male, very conservative act going on between the tables that had Blur and the tables that had Pulp, and thinking, my table's where the interesting stuff's being made. This kind of marginalised area where you had Portishead, you had the remnants of trip hop and all this really interesting stuff, which she said that you can trace right through now to FKA Twigs and James Blake. But the way she makes this great point is like, who says that they're influenced by Oasis now? Nobody. And at the time, we didn't realise how conservative that music was, but it was because in a way we weren't into the nostalgia movement in music yet. But yeah, they were just sounding like the Beatles. It was the Kinks, the Beatles. Blair brought this up in a speech at the Brits in 96.
If you remember, Noel Gallagher kept being done for sort of lifting bits. So he, I think, is Mott the Hoople. Yeah. Was all the young dudes. You know, there's a T-Rex. I think they had to give a bit of cash to. Don't Look Back in Anger has got some similarities to John Lennon's Imagine. It was a very... But the other thing I think about it, which I think it's made for nostalgia, is it's quite a relaxingly irony-free era. Like, it was quite cheesy, right? Mm. It was quite... Like, the patriotism, which John Harris brings out in his cover essay, you know, this adoption of the Union Jack, which clearly people on the left were unhappy with. Our leader from 97 talks about the bulldog imagery of Labour's 97 campaign. And, you know, Jerry Halliwell in the Union Jack dress.
I like how we're never happy. I think that's one of my favourite things about our archive material. It really does not matter where the Labour Party is. We are never happy about it.
But it was one of the first times that the Union Jack was sort of used without any sort of wider sense of this being, is this a troubling thing? The fact that, you know, Foxtons used it on the top of their minis as a kind of...
And even the England flag with Three Lions 96.
Yeah.
And then the rehash of that again, like Three Lions 98. And then they kept trying to do it. Do you remember any music from that era, Stephen, apart from Barbie Girl?
I remember Barbie Girl. I remember... When did the Spice Girls are sort of the first band I think I properly followed the career of through to what Wannabe all the way to Goodbye when Baby Spice left and they had the video.
Ginger Spice left.
Baby Spice, she would not have left the Spice Girls.
Whichever one of the Spices it was then left. I mean, yeah.
It was Ginger.
Ginger. Yeah, I mean, I can't be expected to follow these things. I was teeny tiny. But... So I remember the Spice Girls. What else do I remember from that era? I mean, I was going to say I remember Song 2, but according to your weird timeline, that doesn't count.
Well, I just think a lot of things of Britpop are actually mid-90s, right? So All Right by Supergrass is actually way before 97.
It was early. I
think a lot of it's the kind of thing, and it comes on and I recognise it, because obviously my mum had me indecently young. There are an awful lot of things that I have fallen asleep next to speakers, why I'm now so deaf, have fallen asleep next to speakers of.
Like that great Peter Kay routine about the fact that all the music that we grew up with is just going to sound really stupid. It's like, you know, put on Smack Me Bitch Up, your mum loves Prodigy. Is that what you fell asleep to, Tricky?
Well, there are some things like, so Tamsin Archer, who I know is not Britpop, but that always just sends me straight off to sleep.
That's beautiful.
Even when I can tell it's not something, yeah, even say like Lords of the New Church, objectively a great song and not one which ought to make me sleepy, but at any time in the day I start to feel like, oh, I think
one of the great things about pop music is that, you know, there's always a vast gulf between what the critics say people were listening to in retrospect and what the people were actually listening to. And we were looking at the top 10 singles of 1977. This is the year of punk. Mull of Kintyre by Wings, Brotherhood of Man, Don't Cry for Me Argentina, and Elvis Presley's Way Down, and Hot Chocolate, and Donna Summer. And this is, you know, this is the time that the BBC4 documentaries recast as being, you know, and then suddenly it was all about the Sex Pistols, and it never is.
And actually, no, people weren't putting Satapins through their nose. They were popping home to listen to Mull of Kintyre.
Yeah, those were the ones that they were buying, you know.
Yeah, I think 1997's pop charts are a kind of... the other thing I think is really interesting is there is like Barbie Girl being an interesting example, is the beginning of that dominance of Europop and of Scandinavian songwriters, right? And that,
yeah.
Which became a kind of massive...
Reclaiming it, because obviously in the 70s with ABBA they were doing it, and then it kind of... Yeah, now it's the Max Martins and all the LA songwriting teams are half Scandinavian. And the other massive seller in 95, which is... I think it kept... sold more than Country House, Common People, and Wonderwall was Robson and Jerome's Unchained Melody.
Oh my God.
Which wouldn't happen now, right?
Every so often that comes on Magic FM, and I try and think about what
you
the equivalent...
You listen to Magic FM?
Oh, yeah, and the cab drivers really love Magic FM,
Magic
right?
FM's brilliant.
Anyway, don't judge me, Mr. Barbie Girl. But I now try and think, what is the kind of mid-level BBC programme, or like it was ITV, wasn't it? It was London's Burning. Like, what is the kind of equivalent of that would spawn a star? It's kind of like, I think maybe like the guy from Line of Duty re-releasing, like, I don't know, an Elvis song or something.
Or Miranda
like
Hart doing White Cliffs of Dover or something. Yeah. And the rest of the Call the Midwife cast, you know.
This is what I mean. It was in a way a very relaxingly irony-free zone.
It might have been something to do with the power of terrestrial TV as well. The fact that, you know, everyone was watching these guys on wherever it was Sunday night. So the mums did go out and buy the record. But I can't imagine that happening now.
Is that so? Because the interesting thing is, obviously a lot of grime artists support Jeremy Corbyn, but there isn't that sense of an alchemy between Labour and grime in the way there was between Labour and Britpop, which is odd because in terms of the working class culture or the undercurrents for it to work the same way are all there. Why do you think that hasn't happened in the same way?
I just think it was a phenomenon. It had never happened before, and it's never, I mean, it seems tasteless now. It seems embarrassing that Blair was turning up to the Brits before he got in, giving speeches about the importance of the great British bands harking back to the Kinks and stuff. I think it was just, I remember it very clearly being 15 or 16, and we were all just absolutely entranced by this idea that there could actually be a meshing of popular culture and Number 10. What a great idea. Obviously, it didn't work, and we're very, very embarrassed now.
But also, when in New Statesman's 1997 special edition commemorating New Labour, there was a whole bit of artists and writers for whom this was the first time in their adult life there had been a Labour government, writing like a poem or something to commemorate the occasion. So I think there was a real feeling that, you know, people whose teenage years had been under Thatcher and had been so shaped by that, hang on a minute, our side is winning. Like, this is, and that's...
That was what it was a celebration of, actually, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I wonder if, you know, if Jeremy Corbyn were on course for a massive majority, maybe he would be, you know, up there with Stormzy.
Yeah. I think they might be a bit shy of getting into bed with pop stars now. I think they saw that it didn't quite work because, you know, their promises are never quite going to be followed through on. Pop stars are always going to feel disaffected.
Obama had that same relationship with musicians. And I think in exactly the same way, I remember Jon Stewart on the Daily Show doing a joke about the fact that, you know, now that the Obamas were in the White House in 2008, it was the first time somebody other than country and Western stars was going to perform at the White House.
Right, that was the equivalent for them.
And you did have, you know, the stars of Hamilton. You had Beyonce singing At Last at the inauguration ball. So you did have, and that was again, that was a moment of finally we've got our guy like into power.
Yeah. There was, when we were looking at the songs, there was, I'd forgotten in Three Lions that Blair had actually used a line out of Three Lions in his speech the year before he got in. 17 years of hurt never stopped us dreaming, Labour's coming home, he said at the Labour Party conference. And I don't imagine anybody was cringing.
All those oh so nears. sorry, Stephen.
It really was a more innocent time, wasn't it?
It was just a bubble of very strong feeling, wasn't it?
But economically, economically it was a bubble, as it turned out as well. You know, economically, this is what I mean about the difference between the feeling of this election, even for Tories, who I think, you know, are feeling that they're about to win it really handsomely. It's not a feel-good election. There is no hope and optimism here. Kate, final question. If Theresa May was a band, what band would she be?
Oh, that's difficult. Texas.
Wow. Ooh. You really didn't like White on... What was it? White on... They did do White on Blonde.
They're back.
Wow.
I feel I've offended you.
I quite like Texas the first time round.
Charlene.
Charlene Spiteri, they're Scottish.
Oh, so they're not Sixpence None the Richer. That's a band, not a song, isn't it?
No, they're the ones who did Kiss Me Beneath the Milky Twilight.
Kiss Me, ba 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 da ba something.
Who's the Lighthouse family then in politics?
That's like, I can imagine Boris Johnson on a show going, "We have been lifted," like, and doing the big arms.
Isn't Joe Moore in the Lighthouse family? He lives in a windmill.
That's Jonathan Creek. Another great 90s. I think it was a better time. Anyway, before I drop into a nostalgia coma, thank you, Kate, for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And now I'm going to do a short dramatic reading from the New Statesman's May 1997 special edition, when the magazine ran a leader entitled Dawn Comes Up Like Thunder. Labour's landslide and its little echo for the Liberal Democrats changes everything. Tony Blair can be our best Prime Minister since Churchill. What you're mostly going to hear in the background of this is just slow sobbing from Stephen. Everyone will have a favourite moment from the night Labour achieved the most handsome victory in the party's history. For those following the story on television, it would be hard to beat the announcement at Enfield Southgate when the returning officer had announced that the youthful and charming Stephen Twigg had defeated Michael Portillo. As the camera focused on Twigg's face, his rolling eyes reflected back our collective disbelief at the scale of the triumph. Portillo, a politician remembered only for his graceless attempts to dress his political ambitions in the uniform of the SAS and robes of the monarchy, makes flesh the nation's sense that it could not bear a younger, cruder version of Margaret Thatcher. In choosing Major in 1992, the electorate believed it had brought a nation at ease with itself. Instead, we got a Prime Minister with a tourniquet around his neck. We wish him many happy afternoons watching cricket. Later on the morning of 2nd of May, Tony Blair arrived in London to speak beneath an illuminated blackdrop proclaiming, "New Labour, new government." The first light was creeping up the river from Docklands. "It is a new dawn, is it not?" he murmured, as if the Almighty too had cast a vote. The Labour leader then chose his words with care. Having won as New Labour, he would govern as New Labour. The size of the victory imposed a special responsibility on the winning party to have regard for the whole nation's interests. It was a time to heal divisions. Anyway, I'm not going to read anymore because I think any of our listeners...
This is just masochism, isn't it? I mean, this is...
It's just going to make any of our Labour listeners
I think the worst thing about this is I read this and I go... You know how there's like occasionally you read novels, particularly by elderly authors, and you have a horrible sense of the writer's erection? And it kind of has that problem. But the sad thing is I read this and I think, I feel it's only going to take maybe one, two more election defeats before I too could write this leader without going, whoa, whoa, whoa.
It's going to be a proper Vic Reeves thigh rubber, isn't it, when Labour eventually get back in for our leader. There's just some... There was just some signs in it that, I mean, there are, what I think is it's like one of those great kind of novels of scale where you see the seeds of the eventual horror being sown right from the start. You know, it's like the Chekhov's gun thing. So at the end of it, it says, "We are delighted to see the radical Frank Field at Social Security." Well, as it turned out, he rowed incessantly with and tried to undermine and fell out with Harriet Harman. She lasted only just over a year in the cabinet. That went quite badly. And it's just... It's just got some things in it like...
But like Beyonce, she's a survivor, she's a something else. Anyway.
The greatest leaders trust the people. But yeah, and I just really like the final paragraph says, "The New Statesman has not been comfortable with some of Labour's bulldog imagery in this campaign, but perhaps we can agree that it is a line from Kipling that captures the kind of dawn this is, one that comes up like thunder." And I'm just thinking maybe, Stephen, we should pay some attention already to what literary references we're going to want to use in our leader after the next election 20 years on.
Well, that's a cheerful thought. We'll be
something
back next
from
week.
Dostoevsky, probably. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Helen Lewis, and Stephen Bush. We're produced by India Burke and mixed by James Shields. This week, why not go to newstatesman.com/1997 and wallow in nostalgia? Let's face it, you might not get another Labour government in your lifetime.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.